don't think Putin's going to stop here. If we don't continue giving aid here, I think that we will see him in Poland or someplace else. And Ukraine is just a stepping stone.
Late last year, and 20 episodes ago, Michael DiBenedetto joined us in the studio and made a convincing case for copper bullets over lead, citing collateral damage to bald eagles poisoned through the scavenging of lead-tainted venison scraps. On today's show, we reconnected with Michael in Ukraine, where he's volunteering as a driver with an organization called Road to Relief. Michael drives a truck in the Catskills, too, making deliveries for his company, Vly Mountain Springwater. That's given him some preparation for the mission at hand, but driving on the front lines of Donbas, Michael's front and center in a war that's a year and a half on, with no end in sight. That conversation in a moment. Cat's Cast is sponsored by Briars and Brambles Books, the go-to independent book and gift store in the Catskills, located in Windham, New York, right next to the pharmacy, just steps away from the Windham Path. Open daily. For more information, visit briarsandbramblesbooks.com or call 518-750-8599. And by the Central Catskills Chamber of Commerce, providing services to businesses, community organizations, and local governments in the Central Catskills region. Follow the Central Catskills Chamber of Commerce on Facebook and sign up for a weekly email of local events at centralcatskills.org.
Hello, Michael.
Hey.
Hey, it's working. How are you?
It is working all the way across the other side of the earth.
You know, last time we recorded together, we were discussing the dangers of lead bullets on Catskills wildlife. Now you're contending with artillery fire. I think there's a theme here.
Yes. That's very interesting. I never put those two together, but yes.
As much as you're able to tell me, where are you and what are you doing?
I'm in Slavyansk in Ukraine. It's in the Donbas region in Ukraine, and it's one of the areas where there's a lot of activity going on. What we're doing is the organization I'm working with is doing a lot of humanitarian things, evacuations of people in regions, evacuations of soldiers. They have also a mobile clinic that goes out to help people that are out in the villages, and they deliver lots and lots of humanitarian aid, food, stuff from the United Nations, whatever. What I'm doing in particular is I'm a driver. That's my title.
And you have some experience with that, right? Don't you deliver in the Catskills?
Yes. And some of that stuff now, when I first got here, they had a box truck that was broke down. I repaired that. And it's a little tiny bit bigger than my box truck. But so we've been using that to go out as well where the roads, where you can do it on the road. Some of the roads are so bad you can't take a box truck out on there. But so we've been using that.
What motivated you to travel to Ukraine, Michael, and to volunteer on the ground?
Well, that's an interesting question. What motivates any of us to do good for others? And I think it's, quite selfish on my part, because as you know, anytime you do good for somebody, it makes you feel really good. So that's the reason that I do it. It's for purely selfish reasons.
I wouldn't call it selfish, Michael. That's not the word I would use. But did you have experience with missions like this in the past?
Yeah, Peg and I have gone out on numerous other things. You know, we went down for Katrina. We helped with aid in Haiti. We went to Africa. Sandy, just trying to help out. And, you know, and all of our kids have also done what they can, you know, to volunteer.
Who makes up the team? You say you're a driver. How many people are you working with?
I think there's probably 30 volunteers here right now. The person that organized it, Emma and Henry just left. They've been here for the duration. And they've done relief work all over the world. They were in Greece, in Lesbos. They were in Syria. They've done lots of stuff. And they came here and started just the two of them and then built this organization.
Now, you say you've done work in other places. Let's take Haiti, for example. I think that was following, was that a hurricane or an earthquake, some kind of natural
earthquake.
Disaster?
An earthquake. I think 200,000 people died, initially there. And yes.
Now, this is a little different, Michael, because you're in direct harm's way, I would imagine. Is that concerning to you?
I think it's more concerning to people I know, particularly my family, because, the news makes it seem like it's worse. But I feel pretty safe over here, honestly. I mean, I've never experienced artillery going over me and hitting fairly close, which I have. It's sort of like the lottery. Do you know what I mean? We delivered aid today to a village just north of here, and missiles had struck somebody's house, and it was about three houses down, maybe four houses down, maybe a little more, than the place where we delivered the aid to today. And this happened yesterday, so you know what I mean? It was still smoldering. There's debris in the road. You had to drive around and everything. Could it happen? Of course. But I don't feel that. I feel pretty safe.
What kind of precautions do you take in your day-to-day to stay safe? Is there intelligence on where, might
yes,
be
hit? There always is. And if you're going into a spot that might be a little bit of a hot spot, you dress for that. You're wearing a vest and sometimes helmet, and trying to be careful. You're watching what's going on, watching for drones, this and that. They have an idea, where we should and shouldn't be, and we've been within. I think it's been probably within a little less than a kilometer of the front lines at times.
Wow.
So you could actually hear what's going on. And you could hear the Russian art. That was the only time I've experienced that. Other people have had it many times, the artillery going over you, where you hear the artillery fire, you hear the whistle, like in the movies. Mm-hmm. Remember watching that? If you ever watched those movies, you hear the whistle and boom.
Where are you staying? Do I hear an animal in the background?
Yes, there's some dogs that have been rescued, a bunch of cats here. So we're staying fairly close. They have, they're called the Salt Lakes. It was a pretty big resort area for health reasons. People would come here. There's like three or four lakes that are very salty. They're saltier than the ocean. And there were, before the war, there were resorts around them and whatever, people would come here. That's where we're staying. It's like a big three-story house.
So explain a little bit about what you're doing. What's the day-to-day? Where do your orders come down from? Is it based on what comes in?
Yeah, they have a needs assessment team that goes out pretty much every day. And they go to the different villages. And it's really interesting here that I've just sort of gotten the grasp on, and it's part of why Ukraine is what it is. The villages are very, I don't know how to put this, I don't want to say patriotic, but they're very close. Almost every village has a village center, and some of them have a theater in there, whatever. It's the heart of the village where people go. At these centers, they have a coordinator. So the assessment team goes out, usually meets with coordinators, and they determine what the needs are in this particular village. And based on those needs, we'll take humanitarian aid out, whether it's food or hygiene supplies, doing evacuations and things like that.
What's been the reception by the local people when you arrive with your packages, your supplies, or any kind of assistance?
I have heard that in some of the regions that are closer to the border, whatever, that sometimes they're not well received. I have not seen that. I love the people here. as is typically the case, the people that have the least give the most, and we'll go to these places. I was at a place day before yesterday delivering, and they gave us this great big jar of honey. A lot of work goes into honey, as you probably know. And she was so proud of that, that these were from her bees, whatever. But we'll go places and people will give us fruit, you know, all the produce is in season. Now, it's very similar to New York's climate, except it's been really hot and you have not been really hot. But so grapes and apples and plums and all that are, you know, the gardens, the tomatoes are all ripening. People are always giving us stuff. They'll give us bread sometimes, and yeah, they're just the most wonderful people.
Had you been there in peacetime, or is this your first experience in Ukraine?
No, this is the first time. Peg and I have been traveling through Europe, like staying overnight or something like that. We went to Greece at one point, and on the way to Africa, we spent a night in the UK. But otherwise, I've never done anything in Europe. So, yes, absolutely the first time. I'm a novice traveler. I was shocked when I got to Poland and I hadn't exchanged any money. I still haven't exchanged money. And all the toilets are pay toilets. Mm. And I didn't know what they were saying. And this woman's out there and I thought she was asking for a handout. I couldn't give her anything. And then I went in the toilet and then she sends in this guy to come and get me because I hadn't paid. It's like, oh my gosh, I had no idea.
Wow.
Anyway, yes, I am a novice at traveling.
Is the landscape there similar to the Catskills in terms of the mountains, and are there similarities?
There are a lot of similarities. The plants are so similar. I recognize all these plants that we have. The hills, they have a lot of flat areas. I suspect if you go a little ways out of the Catskills, like more toward western New York, it would look a little bit more like that. They grow, you know, even a few weeks ago, driving out there, the sunflowers, just incredible. As far as you could see this yellow, these yellow fields of sunflowers. Well, they were before the war. I don't know about now. The biggest exporter in the world of stuff made from sunflowers, oil, seeds, stuff like that.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the stories that you've sent home. Are you keeping a journal and sending?
Nope.
Okay.
No, I'll send stories home of what happened during the day so that my family knows what's going on. And I think because Peg can write, and yeah, so I think she's the one that's probably keeping the journal for me.
She shared a few of your emails, something about evacuations of children. Can you explain what that's all about?
So in these places that are particularly dangerous, the government just says you can't have any children here. So you have a choice. You can leave with your children and we'll help you leave. You know, there's money available. There's places where you can go or whatever. Or we will forcibly take your children. So they have a choice. I've been places and I can see both sides that it would be very difficult. There's this young man where we were delivering aid to, and his mom takes care of her mom, it would be his grandma, and some other woman, and she doesn't want to leave them. And the older women, you know, their pigs just had piglets, they aren't going to leave because whatever. And, you know, all these houses around him have been bombed. There's hardly... In some of these regions, there's hardly any houses that are not affected by the bombing. And sometimes people are living in half of the house, or they moved into a neighbor's house that hasn't been hit yet. It's just very sad to go down and see all the damage that's been done. So, you know, as a parent, I can see both sides here. You don't want your kids to be separated from you, but you're taking care of your parents. Or they have their, you know, things that they don't want to leave, because when they leave, a lot of that stuff will get stolen, and they know that. It's nothing's black and white.
There was a video that Peg shared that you sent with this guy fishing by a destroyed bridge and casting his line despite what appears to be some really close artillery fire. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think that was my first day here that we went out to that location. And I got here, I think, 6 o'clock in the morning. I arrived on the train 6 o'clock in the morning. And they wanted to know if I wanted to go out to this location out there. So I did. And it was delivering UN aid out to the coordinator for this one particular village. And I had not heard artillery fire before then. That actually shakes you when it goes off. It's so close. And every time I would jump, now it's like, oh, that's just outgoing. That's no big deal. Even though it goes off and you'll hear the whistle sometimes if you're really close when it goes off. But it's going someplace else. It's different than the one coming in. So now it's not a big deal. But that was just shocking to me that it's so loud. And it's right by these people's, their house. So while they were talking to the coordinator, I walked down. I saw this fisherman down there. The Ukrainians had blown up that bridge, as they did many of the bridges. We drive over a number of pontoon bridges because they wanted to slow the advance of the Russians a year ago. So a lot of the bridges the Ukrainians destroyed, as that train bridge that you saw in the video. But it was just so, I don't even know. Surreal, I guess. The artillery's going off, whatever, and he's there fishing.
You're listening to a clip from that video now. After this next explosion, keep an ear out for the fishing line casting from the rod.
When we were there, I went down to turn our vehicle around while they were finishing up. And I'd heard this tractor coming down, and it's just a little single, it's like going down a little cow path that we were driving on there. And so I went down to turn around so the tractor could get by, and it was a military backhoe. When I came back, this grandma was out with her big stick in front of that backhoe. And she and the operator were having this argument. I couldn't understand it, but our translator said she was very upset because they didn't want the fighting by their house. As you drive around the country, you see trenches dug all over the place. Trenches in preparation for if things happen at that location. Mm. So that's what the backhoe was doing there. It was going to be digging trenches, and it's only maybe 100 yards from this house. And this grandma was like, we don't want this here. And even when they blew up the train trestle there, some of the fragments hit the house. Again, I could see both sides. Nothing's black and white here. The military can't protect Ukraine if they don't have access to things like that. The people that live in the country just want to be left alone. They weren't, they weren't pro-Russian separatists, but they're like, just leave us alone. We don't want the fighting here.
Can you relate to this at all, Michael, if you were here and there was an attack where you live, kind of hunkering down and just continuing on rather than trying to find a way out of there?
Oh, absolutely, especially if you have family there or some of these places have been in your family for generations and you're just going to pick up and move when it is sort of like the lottery, that if it's a bad time in a bad place, it could be your house next. And one of the things that's happening is the soldiers are staying in a lot of these houses as people are vacating or whatever, or even with some of these people. And that makes the house a target. It's just the way it is, but they have no other place to be staying. So no, I can certainly relate to what's going on there. I just couldn't imagine that. you know, again, I can see my family when I was looking at the news or whatever. And part of that is that they look like us. And it's, you know, maybe that's a, I don't know if that's a racist thing to say or whatever, but you can see your family in these people. They look like us. And it's just, I don't know. It's like, I just felt like I had to do something.
Stay tuned for part two of my conversation with Michael D. Benedetto from Ukraine after this. Ulster Savings Bank is a proud supporter of this podcast. Visit them at 68 Mill Hill Road in historic Woodstock. Call them at 845-679-8434 or visit them online at ulstersavings.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. CatsCast is also sponsored by the Hanford Mills Museum, where you can explore the power of the past as you watch the water wheel bring a working sawmill to life. Bring a picnic to enjoy by the mill pond. For more information about scheduling a tour or about their new exploration days, visit hanfordmills.org or call 607-278-5744. Thanks also to the Mountain Eagle, covering Delaware, Greene, and Schoharie counties, including brands for local regions like the Windham Weekly, Schoharie News, and Catskills Chronicle. For more information, call 518-763-6854 or email mountaineaglenews@gmail.com. And now, back to my conversation with Michael DiBenedetto.
Are there other stories that come to mind of resilience or even moments of joy with the Ukrainian people you've met?
The other day, we were delivering aid to a village, and we got stopped at a... So there's all these checkpoints when you drive to these places. There's military checkpoints all over. They'll look through the van. Sometimes they'll go through what's in the van, whatever. We were heading north, a place that's fairly close to the front. And the soldier at the checkpoint said we couldn't go through. He looked at our credentials and whatever and said we couldn't go through. So we had to turn around. And we basically went around the checkpoint through some back roads or whatever. And it took about an hour longer to get to this location. We got to the location, and the person who's navigating, he was talking to the translator. The translator told him, we better put on our vests. They just had an artillery round that hit not very far from there, and shrapnel hit the building where we were delivering the aid. So I didn't even think of it until I'm typing a note up to my family that night about what was going on. And I was like, wait a minute. If we hadn't been delayed at that checkpoint, which we complained about, all these people, you know, there were probably 50 people that were there waiting for aid. We're the only ones that have vests on and stuff. Those people would have been outside. Would they have been hurt? Who knows? But it was just one of those kind of coincidences that was like, oh, here we complained about it, but this is the way it was supposed to be. I think we were pretty fortunate that we were delayed. And I should go back and thank that soldier for giving us a hard time. When we were there, there was this very elderly woman that was walking up the steps, and I took her hand to help her up, and she thanked me or whatever, and she's talking whatever, and I said, I asked the translator, I said, what's she saying? And she said, she wants to know if you already have a wife. And then I didn't go the next day, and the translator was there again, and she said, that woman stopped by looking for me that day, and she was very disappointed and walked back home.
You know, this has been going on for a year and a half now. What's the general outlook of the people you've met? Optimism or just kind of waiting it out?
I think it's waiting it out. I don't see that they feel like they have a choice. Ukraine is a pretty proud, they're pretty proud of what's their country. I don't know if you or the people listening have any ideas of what's gone on, like with Holodomor in the early 30s, when Stalin basically starved the people in Ukraine. A lot of the intellectuals were any intellectuals, whatever. He didn't need those people. He needed the peasants to be producing the grain. So a lot of those people were taken away, sent to the work camps in the Soviet Union, and then he was exporting grain, and the peasants basically bucked the system. They weren't going to do this, and he starved them. And depending on what you read, who you read, there's documentaries that talk about 7 to 8 million people that died of starvation during that time. And it's just incredible what happened. They had these special troops that came in going through people's basements, and it was I don't know if you call it a capital offense, but they executed people if they had tried to save grain in their houses or whatever like that. And these troops would come in, actually go through the houses and take whatever grain, and these people starved. And so I don't know. They've been through this many times, whether it was with the Poles, the Soviet Union, many times.
Tell me a little bit about the food. Are you having local food prepared, Ukrainian food, or is it something that's brought in for your team?
So the house they go out and they buy groceries every 3 or 4 days to feed everybody. I have had some local stuff. I'm a vegetarian. One of the translators is also a vegetarian, and somebody else that just came in yesterday. So I'm not going hungry. And yes, I've eaten quite a bit of Ukrainian food here. For the first time, somebody made the, is it borscht? Is it the beet
borscht,
soup?
Yeah.
I don't even, yeah. They made that last night, and it was actually a translator that made it. It's the vegetarian one, so there was no meat in it. But usually there's meat in everything that they make, but we survive.
Yeah. How'd you enjoy the borscht?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. I never had it before.
Are you bumping into other aid groups, or do you feel like you're going solo?
Yesterday, we bumped into an aid group that was out in one of the villages. It was really funny because this guy, whose also name was Michael, he's looking at me and he goes, "I know you from someplace. We've met before." And I was like, I haven't really done this. And we were talking for a little while, and it turns out when Peg and I went on a sort of vacation, but we did some beach cleaning or whatever in Greece, in Lesbos, he was there at the same time. He went to the same place where we were staying. So it was quite possible. He was just like, "I know you. I've met you before." So it's possible that it was there. But there's a lot of other organizations that are here. I haven't run into them. We're out as close to the front as any of the organizations are. Like I said, within, sometimes within a kilometer.
So you're very close to the Russian border.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Yeah. And when we go out, I mean, we'll see where the artillery is hit here and there, whatever. You'll see smoke here and there. And it's like, oh. Maybe this isn't a good place right now. So yes.
When did you get there, and when are you planning to head back?
So I was hoping to give them 2 months, and it's going to be, I guess, a couple weeks short of 2 months.
I mean, that's a long time to put things on hold back here in the Catskills. How did that?
I couldn't do it without my family.
Yeah.
You know, it was a sacrifice on their part more than mine. It wasn't really a sacrifice on my part. I get all the glory, and it's like being on vacation here. But, they had to pick up the slack for everything. And I'm very thankful that they allowed me to do this. And I don't know if I'll come back. I was talking to the person in charge here, Emma, just a little while ago. And in the wintertime, they don't get as many volunteers, and particularly people that know how to drive in snow. So I said, you know, if it turns out that you're short and you need the help, I don't particularly like the cold, but it is what it is. I'll be happy to come back.
You've got some snow driving experience for sure.
Yes.
What kinds of things can the rest of us be doing, Michael, short of jumping on a plane to Ukraine, or should we be jumping on a plane to Ukraine?
Other people have asked me that. I don't know. I think a lot of it is doing your homework. There's other organizations, the Road to Relief, you can look at and see what they're doing. The reason I got started here was I had read an article. I've been trying to come here since the beginning of the war. And I actually had an interview. It was about a couple months in with an ex-U.S. military person who was helping them here. And his recommendation to me, and he said, all we got to do is a background check. He said, tell your family that you'll be coming over. And it would have been driving ambulances. And it would have been taking the people from the MASH unit to hospitals, not from the front line to the MASH unit. So that was what I was going to do. Something happened with my application. I couldn't get a hold of that guy again, so things just changed. And then I was reading about our DEC, New York State's DEC commissioner, was driving an ambulance across Poland to drop the ambulances off here. And it was through an organization in the UK. I got a hold of him, made the connection here, and here I am.
What's on the schedule tomorrow, Michael?
So tomorrow we are going to a fairly big city, and we're going to meet with a coordinator there of, I think there's a couple thousand people on that are very close to the border. The hospital, I was there that first day that I arrived here. And unfortunately, it was too big for us to handle. So people have, believe it or not, have not been getting the aid. But since I fixed that truck, tomorrow we're going to go back to this city and we're going to see if we can get that box truck in there and bring basically hundreds of boxes of aid to that location. So that's on the agenda for tomorrow to do. We're going to do the needs assessment there, and I'm going to determine, I'm the only one that's now allowed to drive that box truck. And we're going to see if we can get the truck in there, if the road will take it. The roads are incredible. I mean, the problem is the box truck, it's taken out the radiator twice already, and it's about €1,000 to repair that radiator. So I showed him that we can do it down south. And that was the first time they've used that to make these. So we're taking, you know, basically 8 pallets at almost 40. So that's, you know, 300 boxes of stuff, as opposed to the vans where we're taking 50 boxes. So if we can do this, it would be a huge deal.
And you are the only one who's allowed because you have the know-how to fix that thing?
And that they trust to drive it. Yes.
That's great.
Right now, yes.
Well, thank you, Michael, very much. It's great to connect with you. I'm glad we could do this. And hopefully we'll connect again when you're back in New York.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. Thank you for the interest in that. And it's falling off the radar here, and not only is it falling off the radar, but as it does that, a lot of people are saying, we don't want to really send any more aid to Ukraine. We're having enough, you know, we have disasters here. We have to take care of people here. You know, the same thing happened with the wildfires in California or whatever. You know, after a while, people just got tired of hearing about it, but, you know, it's pretty serious what's going on here, and my personal thought is that I don't think Putin's going to stop here. if we don't continue giving aid here, I think that we will see him in Poland or someplace else. I just can't imagine that. You know, the whole idea is to rebuild the Soviet Union. I mean, that's the whole idea behind this. And Ukraine is just a stepping stone, just like Crimea was when they took over part of that. And I just worry about it falling off the radar. There's a lot of soldiers here that are funding themselves. They use their own vehicles. They're provided weapons, but they use their own vehicles. A lot of them are buying their own food, their own clothing, doing whatever. And it's not like they're slackers. They're doing the best they can.
History does have a way of repeating itself, and unfortunately, people have a short memory.
Yeah, we've been here before, haven't we? Yes.
A day after this interview, Michael connected again, this time with his translator, a 27-year-old Ukrainian nurse named Tanya. Next, a brief excerpt from that conversation, and then a special song Michael heard at the Pine Hill Community Center that's resonating with him in Ukraine. Please stay tuned. Cat's Cast is a bi-weekly production of Silver Hollow Audio. For more, visit catscast.com.
Hello?
Yeah. Hello, Brett.
Hey, Michael.
I have Tanya here with me. I worked with Tanya yesterday, and she is a nurse here.
Yes, I am.
And she came to volunteer as a nurse and a medic to probably work with the mobile clinic that they have going out into the community.
Tanya, very nice to meet you. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, nice to meet you too.
Tanya, were you born in Ukraine?
Yes. Yes, I am.
In the country or the city?
I was born in Ivano-Frankivsk, in the little town. In the mountain, in the Carpathian mountain.
And your career there is, before the war, you're a nurse.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
Yes.
I was nurse before the war.
What are you doing now? I guess what I want to say is, what job did you leave when the war started?
When the war began?
Mm-hmm.
What changed in your life?
Oh, my life is not changed now in 2022. It changed in 2030. It was a lot of years.
When Russia first
came into Crimea. Yes.
And tell me a little bit about what you're doing now. What else are you doing day to day?
Oh, I do all what I can for my country, for my people. My friends and me, we are helping all days with food, with medical help. We are working for that. We buy the ambulance cars for my friends who are militaries all the time. Our life is for that. My friends and me, we have 3 or 4 works today, because we need a lot of money for can help to our friends or families who live in the dangerous cities now, or whose families are militaries and need the help.
Are you working or volunteering or both? Are you still able to make...
Both. I'm working in the ambulance, 112, emergency. I am voluntary. I am nurse in a hospital with the doctors
I hear an air raid siren in the background. Is that concerning?
It's typical.
I don't know. And all days after work, the same. In emergency or in the office or in a hospital. After that, when we finish the official work or principal work, mm-hmm. Job, we are looking for the different scenes in the different hospitals who give the different help.
So you have very long days.
Yes, I start at 5 or 6 and I finish at 2 in the night, all days.
When's the last time, Tanya, that you experienced peace?
Peace. Two years ago. Before when my father was military. He died last February here in Ukraine and in Bakhmut.
I'm very sorry.
Thank
you. Do you feel that the world is doing enough to help, or the United States?
I don't know because I think these things so are very difficult, and of course I think all countries, all presidents have the different interests in the war in Ukraine. All the time, not only in Ukraine, in all wars, but I only know we need the help. We need the help because Russia is very big.
Are you angry with the Russian government or the Russian people or both?
Both. Mm-hmm. Because it's, in my opinion, yeah, mm-hmm. Is not only Putin or politic or it's all country, it's all the people, because if you don't say anything, you are the same that Putin and
part of the problem.
What?
Yes, you're part of the problem, yeah. If you don't say anything.
You know, this has been going on for 18 months. Is it any better than when it started, or is it worse, or is it just kind of the same?
I don't know. It's different because it's not stopped. So all day is bad because a lot of people died. The guys, young guys, women, man's
yeah.
Father, brothers.
Yes. Oh,
every day is bad.
If you could say anything to the people who are listening to this in the United States, in New York State, what would you like to say?
We need your help. We need the help because I think in 2020 or 2023 now, it's not good that these things happen. We need the help, only help.
Are the Ukrainian people generally still supportive of Zelensky?
Today, yes. Not Zelensky's name, The people are with the military. Mm-hmm. The people are all together. Mm-hmm. It's the same. His name is Zelensky, or I don't know. Today is Zelensky, mm-hmm. and it's true. He's doing very good job.
So Tanya, is I guess this your day continues now. What are you doing after this call?
We're done.
Oh, you're done.
About done for the night. We're hoping to have dinner.
Oh, good.
Then we have a meeting, and then I hope where that will be done for the night. I hope.
Yeah.
But we have another car that broke down and stuff like that. So yes, that's the way it goes.
Tanya, I want to thank you so much for sharing this with me, and I wish you
nothing. Thank you too.
I wish you nothing but good things ahead, and we're thinking of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael.
You're very welcome. We'll talk again soon.
All right, sounds good.
All
have a good
take
night.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Yep. Bye.
And finally, we leave you with that song Michael heard in the Catskills. Its story of our common humanity resonating now in Ukraine. Many thanks to David Rovics for granting us permission to use it here.
David Rovics is a singer-songwriter that actually stayed at our house. He performed at the Pine Hill Community Center, I don't know, a couple of years ago. And he had had a song about his daughter, and I think it was during the Bosnian War when he wrote this song, that he could see his daughter in a picture of this girl that was there. And it's just an amazing song. But you can see your family in these people, and it's just, I don't know. It's like, I just felt like I had to do something.
I saw her picking yellow flowers, smiling at the sunlight, weaving stems to make a necklace, working hard to get it all right. She reached out to trade it for the bread her mama brought her. And when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. Her feet were bare as mine were. When I grew up in the country, and just like her, I watched my mother hanging out the laundry. Now she's grabbed some clothes and darted off, and her mama chased and caught her. And when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. Now she's running down the alleyway, dust rising up behind her. She hides beneath the rubble, where nobody can find her. And when she tires and walks back home, her mama tells her that she loves her. And when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. Sun sets, she is hungry, but there's no more bread to give her. The cement floor is cold tonight, and beneath the rags she shivers. And as the jet planes scorch the sky, she's longing for her brother. As the bombs fall in the distance, she wonders, will the next one fall much closer? It's not so far to Basra. And I could be her father. 'Cause when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. When I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter.